Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, August 9th, 2018. President Kiir announces amnesty for opposition groups, but one group says all political detainees should be freed.
There is a change in attitude if we see all these South Sudanese who are currently under detention of the regime go free unconditionally.
And the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says all sides must uphold the deal they signed.
The government and the IL both have to build the confidence of their constituencies that they're moving in the right direction. The people of South Sudan have to have confidence in this process.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Opposition politicians' reactions are mixed to President Salva Kiir's decision to give amnesty to rebel leader Riek Machar and all other groups who have been fighting to topple his government for years. An official with the National Salvation Front says his group does not recognize the amnesty offer. Waki Simon Mudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking by phone from Khartoum, General Nathaniel Oyet Pierino, head of the SPLMIO's Governance Committee at the Peace Talks in Sudan, told the South Sudan in Focus the amnesty offer indicates a positive change of attitude by President Kiir towards the opposition. But Oyet says his group wants Mr. Kiir to take many more important practical steps, including the immediate release of all political detainees.
The decree by the president regarding the general amnesty being offered to the opposition, we take it as a change in attitude. But we want this to be accompanied by the release of all political detainees, the release of the prisoners of war, or anyone who is detained in connection with the conflict. We'll only believe that there is a change in attitude if we see all these South Sudanese who are currently under detention of the regime go free unconditionally.
The president's amnesty offer went into effect immediately after being announced on state television and radio last night. President Kiir also renewed his orders to the army to observe the permanent ceasefire as agreed to in the security arrangement deal signed in Khartoum last month and to only fight in self-defense. Mr. Kiir also directed the army and all other organized forces to allow aid workers to access and deliver humanitarian assistance to people in need across South Sudan. Oyet is calling on the government to release hundreds of detained SPLMIO supporters, including civil society activists.
We have those who were abducted from Nairobi, Kenya. We have our former spokesperson, James Gadet Dak. We have Molana Samuel Domlok. We have Agri Idri. We have Marco Loitapio Lokidor. We have people like Elias, General Elias Dadan. We have Peter Sule. We know all these are under government detention.
Yen Matthew, a senior member of the National Salvation Front, or NAS, says his movement does not recognize President Kiir's amnesty offer. He calls the government an illegitimate system that does not have the authority to pardon NAS.
We can only believe in a government that is people's center, which is under. There are so many civilians in the camps today, even around Cuba. If that were to be a people's government, why would people still stay in the camps, even within their own state capital? This, at least, is a good signal that the government is not people's centered, and the people are fearing the government itself. So from where does government get authority?
Kiir's amnesty offer follows the recent signing of a power-sharing and a governance deal in Khartoum, which paves the way for the signing of a final peace agreement by all parties. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A political science professor at the University of Juba says the amnesty offer should cover all disgruntled groups who took up arms against the government. James Okuk says all groups in South Sudan opposition alliance should be covered under the amnesty to avoid another conflict in South Sudan.
Given the history of peacemaking during the Shabab agreement, there was amnesty, but it was general that whoever took gun against the government would get the amnesty, but they are not prosecuted. In the context of the CPA, there was nothing of such kind. It was also considered that the peace agreement itself, the comprehensive peace agreement, was an amnesty for everybody. So nobody really bothered about it. Surprisingly, yesterday, we get this amnesty and has left people wondering why should one particular person and also some particular parties be allowed for the amnesty. And we assume that by the fact that the government has signed a peace agreement with those opposition groups, it means the peace agreement has also given all of them amnesty.
In the text of the presidential decree, there's a mention of the word estranged groups. Who are these groups?
The word estranged group, the origin from the Jemek, and it was adopted by the IGAD mediation for the Island Vitalization Forum later. And even when we read the mandate that was given for the High Level Revitalization Forum, the term of reference, it uses that word of the estranged group. The government had picked that word from there. That word has been contested by the opposition before because it is vague. What is the estranged group? And even when the IGAD was asked and the IGAD was asked, what is the definition of the estranged group? They thought that the estranged group are those who jump out from the transitional government of national unity. And regarding the picking name of Dictoria, is also a bit controversial. And already people have signed for security arrangement and even for the declaration of the permanent ceasefire. And what does it mean when people are just finalizing the peace agreement in Khartoum? It is leaving a lot of questions than answers, that type of amnesty.
What is the future of groups like the National Salvation Front, who opted not to sign the power-sharing deal in Khartoum? And even Paul Malong with his South Sudan United Front, they have not been featured anywhere in these negotiations that is going on in Khartoum. So what is the future of National Salvation Front and Paul Malong's group?
The National Salvation Front is part of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. They have not resigned from the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. So far, they're still considered as part of that. The fact that the interim chairman of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, that is Gabriel Shamsun, the fact that he assigned the breakthrough agreement in Khartoum in the name of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, that entails that also the National Salvation Front, the NAS, is also part of that. Regarding the South Sudan United Front of Paul Malong, that is a different case altogether. They have applied to be accepted within the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. It seems they have not been accepted. The latest was they were trying also to go and merge with the SPLM-IO under Dictoria, but so far nothing has materialized. So they have remained an hot group, and we don't know what will be their fate, because if they remain out alone, it will be very tricky for them to survive if the rest have decided to join hands with the government and the region is behind the peace agreement and implementation. So it will be very difficult for Malong and his group, even for Thomas Cirillo.
That's James Okuk, professor of political science at the University of Juba, speaking from Juba with my colleague John Tanza this past hour. In an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Thomas Hushek says the Trump administration is happy with the progress made so far in the South Sudan peace talks, but wants the country's leaders to uphold their commitment to the ceasefire and work to resolve all outstanding issues so they can sign a final peace agreement. Hushek says the U.S. will take tough measures against people who continue to either obstruct the peace process or divert public funds.
Well, the peace talks are ongoing and they're at a very critical stage. So we're excited about the progress made so far. And we're really hoping that the parties stick to their efforts to come to the table, be willing to compromise where necessary, uphold their commitments first and foremost to the ceasefire, and then start working on ways to resolve remaining issues of conflict. The ultimate yardstick of whether or not there is success in the peace process is whether they can set up a system that resolves conflicts through peaceful means without resorting to arms.
So if the warring parties sign a final peace agreement and the government of national unity is formed, what measures is the U.S. and other countries in the international community putting in place to prevent, you know, the July 2016 scenario?
Well, it is a revitalization of the old peace agreement, so it does look a lot like it. This is some of the reasons everybody remains concerned, and kind of wonder, now how will we make it work this time? One of the first barometers that we look at is whether people are upholding the ceasefire. And in fact, there's been a reduction in violence on the ground. There are still other things that I'm a bit concerned about. I think recruitment is continuing into various militias, and that's something that doesn't necessarily bode well. But I mean, I really think that there's, with this progress already made in Khartoum, you really are hearing a change in the way people are describing what are the next steps. So a lot of people are talking about confidence building. So we know the government and the IO both have to build the confidence of their constituencies that they're moving in the right direction. The people of South Sudan have to have confidence in this process. Similarly, one that the international community talks about is how do we build our confidence in this process going forward? And I think that gets to your question. Are there things that the government or the future unity government and the international community can do to build confidence in each other? Again, first thing is the peace process. Can we see very visible steps that the government is helping us remove impediments to humanitarian assistance? Are there active consultations by the government or by the opposition with civil society? Those are the kinds of things that will build confidence in the international community in the process.
The U.S. government some time back slapped sanctions on some South Sudanese individuals accused of obstructing the peace process and companies thought to be fueling the conflict here. If a final peace agreement is signed and a government of national unity is formed, how long is it going to take to lift these sanctions, and under what conditions will the sanctions be lifted?
Yeah, well, again, the signing of an agreement isn't the final step in the process, of course. This is going to be a long process. Even the transition period set up by the first chapters of this agreement talk about a 3-year period or 3 years plus a pre-transition period, so it could drag on. And I would emphasize that peace, building peace, will take even longer than that. It will have to continue even after elections. So the peace process is a long process, and we will be looking for progress in this long process. It won't be triggered immediately with a piece of paper, but that's, of course, an important first step, a necessary first step. So if we continue to see people seriously obstructing the peace process or diverting the people's money from the people's needs and into war rather than peace and development, then we will continue to take tough measures. If, on the other hand, again, this confidence I was telling you about is resurrected, I think you would start to see some changes.
That was Thomas Hushek, the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, speaking to my colleague Charlton Doki in Juba earlier today. We will bring you the second and final part of the interview tomorrow, when Ambassador Hushek discusses the role of the U.S. as the peace process moves forward. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Kenya opens a human milk bank. Find out what that is when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what are the most successful means to fight corruption?
The most successful means to fight corruption is to punish those who go against the law.
Well, the most successful means to fight corruption, I would say, is one, that the civil servants that are the engine room of government should be well motivated. At that angle, you now start to fight it within.
If everybody had access to a minimum wage and maybe they were content with the salaries that they're getting, probably that would help.
We fight it from the grassroots, from below, by teaching it in schools, children, that there's the need not to be corrupt. If we do that, when they get to the position of leaders, they're not going to be corrupt too.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A ship that saved 87 migrants in distress off the coast of Libya docked in Spain today after roaming the Mediterranean for days. This is the third such vessel to be allowed into the country in the past 2 months after Italy refused to accept the migrants they were carrying. Reporter Josephine McKenna tells VOA's Kim Lewis about the latest rescue and recent migrant protest in southern Italy.
Spain has accepted 87 migrants who docked in the port of San Roque this morning. They've been aboard a ship that's been roaming around the Mediterranean for days. It's a big issue in the Mediterranean, as we know. Italy has tightened its borders and closed its ports. And this is the third ship that's been accepted by Spain since June, carrying migrants, many of whom have been abused in Libya. Now, this ship is carrying 75 men and 12 boys. They spent 50 hours at sea in an inflatable boat with no drinking water before they were rescued. So they've had a pretty intense ordeal, and it looks like they're going to be finding asylum now in Spain.
What is their condition at this time?
We don't seem to have a full update on their condition, but they have suffered burns and damage from the seawater. They're very dehydrated because they had no drinking water aboard. And incidentally, these migrants have come from Sudan, so they've had quite a journey. They've come through Libya, and there are reports that they've suffered serious abuse as they tried to make their way through Libya. They were rescued by the Spanish NGO Proactiva Open Arms, and this is an NGO that is still continuing to operate in the Mediterranean despite the growing restrictions on NGOs trying to rescue migrants. And what the NGOs are finding now is that Italy and Malta are two countries that are not accepting migrants, and so forcing these NGOs to take them to other locations, and in this case, Spain.
And what is the Spanish government saying about all of this?
Well, the Spanish government is a new socialist government that has only been in power a few months, and it has taken a much more open approach to accepting migrants. It feels a social responsibility. But it's important to emphasize that Spain has not yet suffered the backlash that many other European countries have, like France, Germany, Italy, for accepting migrants. So, if you like, it's a period where the Spanish government can afford to accept migrants and has certainly been adopting a much more open approach. It remains to be seen whether people will have a reaction against that in the near future.
And another migrant story there in Italy, there were protests that occurred after 16 migrants were killed in road accidents returning from work. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, hundreds of migrants, agricultural workers in southern Italy, walked off the job in the fields where they were picking tomatoes around the area of Foggia, a town in the southern region of Puglia, yesterday. They were marching with signs saying, "We are not slaves, no to exploitation." They feel pretty angry, not only about the accidents, but the fact that they are earning up to $50 a day for backbreaking labour in scorching temperatures. They're living in rural ghettos with no electricity, no running water. So the conditions of these shanty towns are really extreme and they feel like nobody's listening. They're also very upset about the accidents that occurred, the loss of their friends and loved ones. And two of the survivors, one from Senegal and one from the Gambia, also spoke of their shock and upset to have lost their friends in these terrible accidents.
Has there been any reaction to these protests?
There was an outcry across Italy about the accidents themselves, and there's a lot of sympathy for these protests. In fact, the anti-immigration minister, Matteo Salvini, even went down to meet the migrants and spoke about trying to wipe out some of the organised criminal networks that linked to this industry. Now, that's a tall order, but that's certainly a pledge from the government to try and offer greater protection to these migrants.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis from Rome Today. We turn to neighboring Kenya now, where the country is banking on human milk to reduce newborn mortality. Kenya is only the second country in Africa to open a human milk depository, or milk bank, for babies in need. Rael Ambor has the story from Nairobi.
Joshua Okumu's wife, Mary Mwanje, died during childbirth 18 years ago at Pumwani Maternity Hospital, but their daughter survived. When he picked up his newborn baby at the nursery, grief-stricken and shocked, Okumu was not entirely sure how to feed her.
So when we reached home, I started feeding her with a packet of milk, which is called Tuzo. So, you know, by that time, Tuzo was not diluted like nowadays. So That's what I was using when feeding the small baby when I took her from the hospital. It would have been if the mom was I think it would have been healthier for her to be fed by her mom.
For Kenyan widowers like Okumu, there will soon be another option, human donor milk. Nairobi's Pumwani Hospital is getting the first ever breast milk bank for Kenya, only the second country on the continent after South Africa to open a milk bank. This is a joint initiative between Kenya's Ministry of Health and PATH, a US-based non-profit health organization. The milk bank will open in September for donations and offer free breast milk by prescription to babies who cannot get it from their mothers. Dr. Elizabeth Kimani Murage, head of maternal and child well-being at the African Population and Health Research Center, is behind the project.
The World Health Organization has recommended that if the mother's own breast milk is not available for the baby for any reason, the next best option would be the donor milk. So so the recommendation is that to make donor milk available to babies, such vulnerable babies.
The milk bank aims to help orphaned and malnourished babies get the essential nutrients they need for healthy development. Dr. Murage says mother's milk has an enormous impact on child survival, especially during the first months of life.
Despite improvement like in infant mortality, in child under 5 mortality, neonatal mortality is reducing in a very slow rate. So those are the children that we want to target. According to the every newborn action plan, we should actually reduce neonatal mortality to 12 deaths per 1,000 live births. But you see, we are very far. We are at 22.
Despite the free breast milk, there are misperceptions and concerns about hygiene and that disease could spread from donors to babies. But Dr. Murage notes all donors will be health checked at the hospital and the milk pasteurized to ensure that only safe and healthy breast milk is given to babies in need. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new South African political party wants the government to expel all foreigners because they claim foreign nationals bring crime into the country and are responsible for high unemployment. While it is unlikely the African Basic Movement Party will win big in next year's poll, its emergence is a sign, analysts say, that the global wave of nationalist populist politics is going to be part of the 2019 election in the Rainbow Nation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
African Basic Movement party leader Tembelane Ngubane says the party he started last year has gained tens of thousands of members and signatories to its petition to deport all foreigners by year's end. Those numbers could not be verified.
We should get rid of all foreigners who are here. They are taking South Africa's jobs. They sleep with our sisters. They give them children. They get married to them so that they get South African citizenship. When they get them, they abandon them. So South Africa is like chaos. And they are criminals. We can't catch them. They have no fingerprints because they are from other countries.
The party is registered for the 2019 elections, but critics question whether its platform adheres to South Africa's inclusive constitution and whether its position leans dangerously towards hate speech, which is illegal in South Africa. Lawyers for Human Rights Refugee and Migrant Rights Program leader Sharon Ikambaram says she worries the rise in xenophobic politics could spur another outburst of violence. She adds that researchers have found foreign nationals are often job creators and are not disproportionately responsible for violent crime.
I can't even articulate how dangerous this is for our democracy. This is clearly a group that is racist, they're xenophobic, and this is, I can substantiate that because of the statements that they're making. And I don't think there's a place for those kinds of people in our country. And I think that it's serious that the Electoral Commission needs to investigate if they have actually registered as a political party, whether that is constitutional for a party, because then it makes space for someone who's a fascist or a racist to form a party. It makes no difference to me to the apartheid regime that said that only white people belong to South Africa.
Political analyst Ralph Matega says the ruling ANC's numerous corruption scandals and its inability to reduce unemployment and poverty makes it easier for extreme beliefs to enter the mainstream.
South Africa's politics is going in that direction of populism. You have always had that level of leftist populism that has been there within South African politics. But seeing that is very, very different is the emergence of nationalist populism. Now, usually, these are the thoughts that you could just dismiss as the thought by loonies. Each and every society has those people on the outlier who push these kind of ideas. And if the center of your politics have got legitimacy, if the party that is in power has got legitimacy, it is accountable, it is doing things properly, that does not allow that kind of populism to try to compete to be at the center.
Matega also said the global growth of populist politics makes it easier for groups like this to emerge. Ngubane says he wants South Africans to succeed.
Donald Trump is putting Americans first. Here, we are putting South Africans first. You see, you cannot let your child sleep on empty stomach and feed your neighbor's child. That is the problem. Here in South Africa, our children sleep on empty stomach. Our neighbors, like Pakistan, Chinese, they sleep on full stomach. We don't want that.
He adds his party has a wider vision. He wants to abolish the presidency and make South Africa a kingdom, led by a king and a prime minister. He also says he wants to promote the use of local languages and official communication and encourage the traditional family unit. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Heroes of Our Nation by Victoria Olay. I'm Ayen Dangbior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
The heroes of our nation have fought the battle. Take us home, oh mama. The beat of liberation is coming to settle, so we can go to Juba. Oh, commander, when we see you smiling, holding your pride, we know, surely no wonder that our peace is coming. It's time.
Podcast.